It's time for Deputy Leader Fletcher Tabateau from the New Zealand First Party.
Yes, indeed. We don't have any ads today, so we're going straight into it. Fletcher is back with us on a Wednesday. I spoke to Fletcher this morning about contact tracing, an injection of cash into the regions, and the announcement from the Serious Fraud Office that their decision regarding New Zealand First political donations will be out before the election. I started by asking how he felt about moving to Level 3 next week.
Yeah. So I was personally very pleased to hear that we would be extending it. I think the eradication strategy is really important. There's a lot of comparisons being made to Australia at the moment, and somehow they're doing it better. But when you look over there and you talk to people in Australia, actually a lot of businesses are shut down, and even though schools are technically open, most parents aren't sending their kids to school, and the teachers don't want to be there anyway. You know, there's a whole confidence issue.
Yeah, and what is the sort of comparison with Australia? Because my understanding, they're not in a sort of level 4 type lockdown that we are in. They're, you know, it's been called level 3 plus or something.
Yeah.
But it also, we speak to a Radio Adelaide correspondent just to get a, you know, once a week look at what's going on in Australia. And actually over the weeks, what I've found is that it seems quite confusing what's happening throughout all of Australia, you know, everyone at different kind of levels. And something that's kind of similar to America, I suppose, too, with each, you know, state.
Yeah, federal system as well.
Yeah. And so you have a sort of difference of what's going on. So what is the comparison with Australia?
Well, some people are trying to make the argument that economically Australia will be better off because they haven't shut everything down. The reality, though, is that actually whilst the instruction from government might not have been there, a lot of industries have shut down anyway, and people aren't undertaking day-to-day business. And what I think we're seeing with their Level 3 Plus is they intend to be in that Level 3 Plus for quite a few months, actually, and with no, you know, short-term vision of coming out of it anytime soon. So the actually, although the number of deaths and infection rates seem to be similar, I personally doubt it, but they seem to be similar. Actually, hospitalizations in Australia are massively higher, like 6 times per capita. So that's got to tell you something about the data. And Professor Skegg, who has been advising the Response Select Committee, kind of alluded to that in one of his introductions to the Select Committee one morning, that we can't really take those numbers at face value because there's this whole issue of hospitalizations and where are they coming from if their infection rate is similar to ours. It doesn't really make sense. So when we come back to New Zealand and the decisions we've made, we've got to acknowledge how incredibly tough it's been, especially on business owners, but, you know, people who are employed in those businesses as well. But the reality and the hope is that having made these hard calls now, we get to come out of it a lot quicker and a lot more successfully, and what that means, what we hope that means, is that we don't yo-yo back into level 4 again, which we're already seeing around the world, even in countries where which other people were holding up as kind of gold standard examples of how we can do both business and address the health issues.
Okay, and on the note of, in terms of moving out, one of the reasons that we did delay it from that original 4 weeks that was never sort of set in stone, but it was a kind of ballpark, I guess, but one of the reasons was that our contact tracing isn't necessarily up to standard, and it's been thrown around as the gold standard that we need to get to. And I know that money has been put into this, and work is being done on that. So what would a gold standard contact tracing look like?
Well, I'll just kind of, I'll not correct you, but kind of put the counter argument out there. We held for another week, not because we weren't ready for contact tracing, but because the eradication plan, the numbers weren't quite there yet. And if we'd come out, you know, what's today? Today or last night or whatever it was, the numbers of infection rates weren't quite at the level where we would be comfortable that it wouldn't just, exponentially blow out again. So the independent audit was done and identified some, well, they made some recommendations. But you've got to put this in the perspective of time. So this has all been over 4 weeks today. And so at the time, even that the audit was done, there might have been some identifiable issues which came out in the recommendations. But just like just mainstream testing, as people were complaining about testing not being sufficient, we very rapidly became one of the highest testing rated countries in the world. So I would put it to you know, everyone out there, that our contact tracing system would have been up to it today if that had been the decision, but the response has already been that, okay, let's plan for worst-case scenario and make sure that should our eradication strategy not work, that we can contact trace massive numbers, and that's been 55 million more into the health system, with 15 more into those health units, those kind of portable health units, and the staffing of those as well.
So, and what does that actually mean in terms of the gold standard again? Like if you're saying that we would have been up to that standard at this point, what does that look like? Does that just look like more people on the ground, more people talking, more people being able to ask questions, yeah, like where have you been?
Yeah. So you want to know that if there's 100 cases tomorrow, oh my God, where did they come from, that there's physical capacity of people to be deployed to those points of infection and go, right, sit down, tell us who you've been in contact with over the last, you know, week. And then not only that, the capacity then to go to those 100 people and go, right, how are you feeling? Let's do a test. And who have you been in contact with over the last, you know, probably lesser time? I'm not sure about the exact days that they need to go back. It would probably depend on determining when the original person was infected. But so you've got to have that capacity in terms of technology, keeping a record of that, and then literally feet on the ground, people being able to process and have those really, really important conversations quickly.
And that money that has gone in, and I think it was saying that there would be, or it was going to be enough for hiring 300 extra staff. So where will they come from, and what sort of qualifications do they need to have?
There was a call, if you remember, to recently retired or people who were previously, you know, of the medical profession to a certain standard.
Yes, right. I do remember. Okay.
Yeah, and so I imagine, and you know, that is where a lot of them will come from, and it's operational, so I'm not sure exactly, but I would determine that most of them would be experienced medical professionals, and if they had staffing that wasn't, that they'd be paired, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And but you'd have to go to the actual operational people making those decisions to get a real understanding of what that would look like on the ground.
So I just want to go to the Epidemic Response Committee, because obviously you're part of that, and they heard a lot of, I suppose, criticism. I mean, there's been criticism generally. There's been a big post from Simon Bridges, which is being talked about in terms of, you know, this is not being good enough. So what would you, do you have any kind of concerns from the Epidemic Response Committee that you think are valid?
Well, everyone's concerns are valid. Because there's not an element of truth. There are real concerns from different people, from different sectors of society. So you have to ask yourself and balance what's the right approach. And so Minister Robertson was on the committee yesterday morning, and he addressed the fundamental concerns about the economic response. So Sweden, for example, you know how they have essentially gone, well, we'll see how we go. We won't do quarantines. We can still, you know, businesses can operate. Even with that mentality, they're still about to go into 10% unemployment over there. And New Zealand's numbers currently tracking might be just under that when we pull out of level four. And yet we have a fraction of the deaths and compared to Sweden. So what I would say to anyone listening out there, the best economic response to this is a health response, because, you know, even if you're kind of Machiavellian about how you perceive things in the world, you need your customers to be alive, and you need your staff to be healthy, you know, and without that, and without confidence of people being sure that they can go back out into the world, there is going to be no business. So the best thing we can do for business is the same thing we need to do in terms of the health response, is eradicate it and move on as quickly as possible, but not so quick that we compromise the amazing efforts that we've seen from just about everyone in New Zealand who have stuck to the plan, which means, what was it yesterday? Five cases,
yeah.
So if we can keep that up, we have done, in my opinion, the best thing that we possibly could have done for the economy and the lives of New Zealanders.
I want to touch on Shane Jones announced an injection of cash for the regions. Can you explain that, and where would that go? What's needed at the moment?
Yep, so it's at the decision-making phase at the moment. So what I was talking about when we spoke last week was the regions, and we're definitely having a regional response, but in terms of all of government, there's going to be massive kind of infrastructure programs and big employment strategies to get people back into work and actually to optimise the opportunity to, say, actually infrastructure in New Zealand's kind of decrepitly old and it needs to be updated, so let's do something about it and create jobs at the same time, which is actually quite exciting. What Minister Jones has been able to say in terms of the Provincial Growth Fund in the regions is actually the picture of the regional economy has changed since the PGF was brought in. Now what we need to do is repurpose the money we have left and still talk to the regions, still get in there and then ask the same question again in this COVID time and say, what do you need? And what the PGF is really good at, the Provincial Growth Fund, has been over the last 2 years being quite rapid in terms of getting money and investment out there, and quite flexible in terms of dealing with individual cases, whether they're councils or businesses or iwi or Māori trusts, you know, about coming up with good ideas. So what we're trying to do and what we will do is make sure that we're responding quickly and getting on with what we're terming shovel-ready projects out there.
And that's being thrown around a lot, I think, this term shovel-ready projects, which means we sort of hit the ground running, right? So the PGF has been great in terms of injecting capital, but concerns around it actually creating a vast number of jobs, you know, that hasn't really translated. Are you concerned that could also be the case now?
So I know the Minister said we needed to do more in terms of jobs, and there's an element of truth to that, but there's also the question of timing. You don't invest in infrastructure that hasn't essentially even begun yet and then suddenly expect there to be jobs created. You know, you still have to go. A business doesn't create 100 jobs the next day, even when it borrows $1 million from the bank. It's got to go through the natural process, and that's what had been happening. What will happen with this is, yes, this will have more of a focus around immediacy. Why are you telling us it's shovel ready? And when you say it's shovel ready, well, how many jobs and when's that going to happen? So that becomes more of a focus as opposed to long-term regional economic development, which isn't necessarily jobs straight away, but, you know, they do come because you're developing the economy, whereas under COVID, the question now becomes, well, where are we going to create jobs and how quickly can we do that and what real projects have you got ready to go?
Just very quickly, we touched on the election date last week and we still, you know, can't really say on that, but the SFO has announced that their decision around New Zealand First's political donations will be released before the election.
That's exciting. That's good news.
Do you think? Okay, well, that's good. I was going to say, do you think that that decision, regardless of what it is, do you think it will have an impact on the election campaign for New Zealand First?
Well, as far as we're concerned, we took two lots of legal advice before we ever went down any path. We copied the National Party's program and the way they do things. And so
you copied the National Party?
Well, the way they do fundraising. So
they're also in the SFO, though.
Anyway, for different issues. But
okay.
You're right. They are also they're actually being charged by the SFO. So what we're saying is we believe our hands are clean on this. So the sooner that the SFO can put a case forward and have that heard, the better it will be for us, so that, you know, people can understand that we have always acted above board.
That was Deputy Leader Fletcher Tabateau from the New Zealand First Party.